Today we are coming to a very important event and story in the history of Israel. We're going to look at the story of the making of the golden calf. And this episode is so important that I'm actually going to deal with this not only this Sunday but next Sunday. So you need to come back next Sunday to get the second half of this lesson that we're beginning today. But what I want to talk about this morning is the problem of idleness. I heard a story about an older woman who was taking her very first plane trip across the country. She boarded in New York and she was flying to Los Angeles. She had never in her life been on a jet before. And after they had taken off and gone a ways, she motioned to the stewardess and mentioned that her ears were popping. And the stewardess said, "Well, actually, that's kind of a pretty common occurrence in airline travel." And the stewardess took out some gum and gave her some gum. She said, "You know, this really seems to help people a lot." The older woman thanked the stewardess. Several hours later, they landed in Los Angeles. And again, the older woman kind of motioned for the stewardess. She said, "You know, that really did help, but how do I get the gum out of my ears?" You've probably been in a situation in your life where you felt like you communicated something clearly. There wasn't any way that somebody could possibly misunderstand what you were trying to say to them. I'm sure that God felt that way when he gave the Ten Commandments at Sinai. Last week, we saw that Moses was down in the midst of the people and he heard the voice of the Lord speak audibly and speak very clearly about what it was that he expected of Israel as they were going to enter into this covenant with him. God made it very clear about what he thought about the problem of idleness. In fact, look with me at the very first words they actually heard from that mountain. And remember, that mountain is covered in a thick black swirl of smoke with lightning and thunder, and the mountain is shaking, and they hear a trumpet getting louder and louder, but there's no trumpeter. Exodus 20, verse 1. "And God spoke all these words, 'I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below.'" Now, just like in the garden, God's children heard God's words. They understood precisely what it was that was expected of them. And just like in the garden, God's children decided that they could rethink what God had actually said. And just like in the garden, the result of their choice was loss of intimacy with God. Usually when people study through the book of Exodus, especially when you're looking at the life of Moses, you read all the way up to Sinai where the Ten Commandments is given, and then the giving of the law, and there's the five or six chapters that include the building of the tabernacle. And we skip all of that to get to the really good story, the making of the golden calf. But I would suggest you can't really do that and really appreciate the story. This story about the golden calf has got to be read right in the midst of the context of the chapters that are right in front of it. Because right in front of the five or six chapters that God lays out very specifically and precisely the fact that he wants them to build a tabernacle. They've entered now into a covenant with God, and he's given them the law, and the people have said, "We're going to keep this law. God, we're going to obey this law." So God gives them the instructions. Look at Exodus 25, verse 8. "Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Now, it hasn't actually happened yet. They haven't built that. God is still up on the mountain, on Mount Sinai. God says, I want you to build a place for me, and I will come and be with you, live with you. This is entirely a divine initiative. This isn't something that Israel has asked for. This is God telling them this is what he wants. This is God's idea. I want you to build this for me. So instead of the occasional appearance of God traveling to a mountain, we see God. Now Israel is being offered the ongoing, continual presence of God with them. Let's write this down. The tabernacle signified God's desire to dwell intimately among his people. God with us. Emmanuel. That's not just a New Testament concept. God is saying, you're not going to have to make any more trips to a mountain or up a mountain to be in my presence, because I'm willing to come down the mountain. I am willing to live in the very center, in the very heart of the nation. The tabernacle was going to be a sort of, if you will, a portable Sinai, so that the presence of God was always going to be in the midst of the people. Now, you've got to remember this, what I'm telling you right now, as you get into the story of the golden calf. In fact, look with me at the very end of chapter 9, starting in verse 42. It says this: for the generations to come, this burnt offering is to be made regularly at the entrance to the tent of meeting before the Lord. There I will meet you and speak to you. There also I will meet with the Israelites, and the place will be consecrated by my glory. So I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar, and will consecrate Aaron and his sons to serve me as priest. Then I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. They will know that I am Yahweh, their God, who brought them out of Egypt so that I might dwell among them. I am Yahweh, their God. That's significant. That is huge. God says, I brought you out of Egypt so that I could live with you. He's promising something the Hebrews have never known in their entirety of history. Moses is up on the top of that mountain receiving the building plans from God on how to do this, what to do with it. But at the bottom of the mountain, the people are starting to make some building plans of their own. So we come now to chapter 32 and the story of the golden calf. 32 verse 1 says this: when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. Moses has now been gone for about 40 days. He did not take any food with him. He did not take any water with him. He did not take any provisions with him. He went up into that dark, swirling cloud, and they've not heard from him since. So Aaron tells them to get all of their gold, all of their ornaments, all of your earrings, and then he melts it down, and he makes this golden calf, and he says, here's your God. And then in verse 5, it says this in 32, chapter 32. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to Yahweh. Now, what commandment did the Israelites break? It was not so much the breaking of the first commandment, but it was the second, the worship of the first commandment is the worship of false God. That's the first commandment, the worship of false gods. The second commandment is the false worship of the true God. So the golden calf represented their attempt to worship God on their own terms. The problem isn't really the absence of Moses up on the mountain. The problem is the absence of their faith. Idolatry is always an attempt to walk by sight, to have a God that you can hold and see and handle and control. Write this down. Idolatry is for people that refuse to take God as he is. That's what God forbids in the second commandment. Don't make images of him. Just take him like he is. What's the appeal of idolatry? I mean, do you think people were really back then so dense that they thought they could put some gold and wood together and that somehow became a god? No. Idolatry is more than that. It is worshiping something that you ought to be using. Or it's using something that you ought to be worshiping. That's really why men love to make images of their deities. I want to list out for you several reasons why people love to actually make idols. Because it's not about gold and silver or calves. There are all kinds of ways people today can be idolaters. Here's the first. Because it takes away the mystery. We like a God that we can control. Instead of a God who does what he wants, when he wants, how he wants, we can control what we want our God to do. You need to be very wary, by the way, of people that would tell you they've got God all figured out. Be wary of people who say to you, you know what, if you will do this and this and this, then they can predict for you what God has to do next. That's what people love about idols and their gods. Because it takes away the mystery. Secondly, because it locates their God. We like for God to stay put. And this shows up in many ways. Right here in our nation, some people actually worship clergy. There's a trend in the United States of having celebrity pastors of gigantic mega centers of worship. People actually, I've known where they would bring their Bible to their favorite well-known celebrity evangelist pastor and have him autograph their Bible. I kind of thought that the author should only be the one to autograph his book. People think, you know what? If I'm in a right relationship with my pastor, then I'm in a right relationship with God. That's not how it works. Remember that old commercial? That's not how any of this works. Some people actually make buildings their God. They have all of these rules for a building that they don't have for another building. Some people make miracles their God, because that's where God is located. You know where God is if you can actually see a miracle take place. Some people make church tradition their God. You ever wonder why some people get so bent out of shape if a tradition in the church is changed? Remember the very first time my wife and I, she wasn't my secretary back then, but I decided to change the bulletin. I did not know that that was a big deal. I found out very quickly it was. We have all kinds of ways where we actually want to locate our God. Henry Ward Beecher was a famous preacher at the Plymouth Church in New York City. His brother wasn't as well known as him, wasn't as good, frankly, as a preacher as his brother. His brother's name was Lyman, and one Sunday, Henry Ward Beecher had asked his brother Lyman to fill in for him while he was out of town. Well, a lot of people would just flock to this church, Plymouth Church in New York City, to hear Henry Ward Beecher. And that particular Sunday morning, when Lyman, his brother, got up to preach, a number of folks got up to leave. And his brother Lyman said, "All of you who came to worship Henry Ward Beecher are excused. Those of you who are here to worship God can stay." You see, the appeal of idolatry is that you get God located in a man, in a building, in a belief system. But the reality is we cannot do that. God cannot be finite located to a place or person. Also, another reason is because it lets us fashion God. There's a temple in Kyoto, Japan, called the Temple of the Thousand Buddhas. And if you were to go into this temple, you would see over 1,000 statues, life-size statues of Buddha, but every single statue is just a little different. And what you do is you go into this temple and you find the statue of Buddha that closely relates to you the most, that looks like you the most. That's what people do with idolatry. God made humans in his image. And ever since then, we've been trying to return the favor. Emil Durkheim, who was not a believer, was the first to actually postulate a theory called reification. And in this theory, he basically says, religion is a crock. Religion is just an attempt of selfish men to justify behaviors that they want to engage in under the cover of a god. I think it sounds like an appropriate description, to be honest with you, for certain kinds of religious entities in our world today. But Durkheim said that this is something that all religions end up doing. Durkheim said, if you want a war god, then just go ahead and create a war. Or if you want war, then create a war god. If you want freedom and no sexual boundaries, then go ahead and create a love god. Durkheim would challenge you, just study the history of mankind, and whatever people want to do, guess what? They make gods that tell them that's okay. Well, that's what idolatry will let you do. Idolatry will let you shape God and mold God in the way that you want him to be, so that he endorses who you want to be. I have so many individuals that have told me over the years, whenever I speak out about sinning against God sexually, and they'll say something along the lines of, well, my God, and then you can fill in the blank. My God doesn't judge. My God wants me to be happy. I'm not too interested in what your God says. I want to know what the God says. And what people do in our nation is that we create a God that tells us we can be who we want to be. Just look at all the TV preachers on your television. Notice as they preach how many times that God definitely sounds like he's Republican. And he's all about enjoying the finer things of life. He wants you to be wealthy. He wants you to always be healthy. By the way, that God is typically almost always Anglo. Because the people that support those kind of preachers and television shows are just like that. And if you challenge any of those particular positions, then you are the problem. You're not very religious. I'm not attacking those positions. I'm simply saying, don't think that because we don't have a golden calf sitting up here on the stage that we don't have a problem with idolatry. Psalm 115, verse 8 says, "Those who make them will be like them. And so will all who trust in them." That's talking about idols. We become like the God we worship. Do you know the second commandment out of the Ten Commandments is mentioned more in the Bible than all of the other commandments? And we don't think that we actually have to worry about graven images. God knew how much we would struggle with this. So why does God have a problem with this anyway? Why can't we do our best to come up with an image of God that would help us actually worship God? Well, let me give you several reasons. Here's the first one. You cannot image God adequately. Let me ask you a question. Do you like a bad picture of yourself? Somebody wants a family photo, and there you are in the family photo right before that's taken, and your face looks like... Look at this. Look at this on the screen. That's my driver's license photo. I look like a serial killer. Why is it that our driver's license photos always look so bad? If you do not like a bad photo of yourself, what makes you think Yahweh wants one? Idols are like caricatures. You ever had a caricature done at the state fair or at a, you know, some kind of place like that? You sit down and you smile for the person drawing, and all of a sudden they give you a picture and your nose is this long and your ears are that giant, and you look really, really weird. And that's what an idol does to God. They take one facet of God and they highlight that into an immense way, but they can't ever really show you the whole picture of who God actually is. A calf in ancient thought spoke to power and strength. But what about holiness? What about mercy? What about purity? The people that are worshiping that calf were also being immoral right in front of that calf. Because calves don't really care about purity. That's one reason God says, don't image me. You cannot do a good job. You cannot adequately present my likeness. Another reason that God hates images of himself is you cannot locate God. God refuses to be put into a box. He will not be put into a box called a church building. He will not be put into a box called Orthodox theology. He will not be put into a box called your religious tradition. You can't locate God. In fact, idolatry produces a real sick theology where God is confined. And thus, he's absent from a whole lot of your life. God doesn't let you do that. You know why else? You cannot use God. Remember what the Israelites did in 1 Samuel chapter 4? They were at war with the Philistine nation. The Philistines had a very big army, so the Israelites said, hey, let's go get God. He lived in the ark, right? He's in that box. So they went and got the ark of the covenant of God, but God let them suffer a tremendous military defeat. That's because you will not use God. Any theology that obligates God is idolatry. Idolatry is men trying to make God in his image, and God will not let himself be reduced. And when we image God, we are reducing God. Whenever you have the presence of idleness, you have the absence of God. Write this down. When men refuse to take God as he is, God refuses to take men where they need to be. God will not remain where men prefer a substitute. Look with me at Exodus 33, because I want you to see what happens when we try to reduce God. And remember the context. Exodus, God has just said, build me a house because I want to live with you. I want to be in your midst. But this is all before the golden calf. So look what he says. Then the Lord said to Moses, leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go up to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey. But I will not go with you, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you along the way. By attempting to reduce God to a golden calf, the Hebrews had removed themselves from the sphere of that promise that God would dwell with them. And consequently, they're facing a future that is more ominous than anything that they actually experienced back in Egypt. What Yahweh is doing is he's saying, I'm going to grant you your wish. You want a little God? Well, you can have him. And I'm staying right here. In verse 3, where God refers to the Israelites as a stiff-necked people, that's an interesting word in Hebrew. It comes from the same root for the word that's translated hard. Remember, Pharaoh had a hard heart, and God is saying, you know, you people remind me of Pharaoh. You're stiff-necked. And I know his decision to stay and not go with the people was an act of judgment, but it was also actually an act of mercy, because twice he says, if I travel with you, I might destroy you. That's one of the reasons, by the way, there have been times that my wife and I have been in an argument, and I'm glad she was not holding a knife at the time we were arguing. She might have destroyed me. God cannot remain where he is mocked without releasing his wrath. Let me tell you something. When God says, I'm staying, you go on without me, he's not meaning that he's not omnipresent, like he's not present everywhere. What he's saying is that his special manifest presence, his glory, will not be with them. It will not be among the nation of Israel. Now, here's something very important. That does not mean that Israel cannot still do some amazing things. It's important to know that even in the absence of God's manifest presence, that doesn't mean that you cannot still go into the promised land. That's an amazing thing to me. God allows you to experience some wonderful things, but he can withhold his presence. And that's the problem. The problem with idleness is that we get so satisfied with a reduced God and the way things are that we don't even long for a visitation of the true God. We don't even know what it would mean to experience things how they could be. Revival never comes to a satisfied person. I think what we have here in America are a lot of churches and Christians who, frankly, are fairly content, fairly prosperous, with a lot of good things going on in their lives, and we have been so accustomed to doing those things without the special manifest presence of God in our midst that we have become satisfied with how things are. In fact, if God showed up in a powerful way, it would scare us. We'd have to call a special meeting. God is not going to send his presence until we mourn his absence. Look at Exodus 33, verses 4 and 5. It says, when the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn. And no one put on any ornaments. For the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you, even for a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments, and I will decide what to do with you. When Moses went back up that mountain, it wasn't just to beg God to let Israel live, it was to beg God to come live with Israel. It wasn't enough to say God is above us, or God is by us, or even God is for us. He would not settle for anything less than Emmanuel. God is with us. That's what he went up that mountain to do. One of the great theologians in our nation was a man named Charles Hodge from Princeton Seminary. He fought a great fight, honestly, if you read through history in the early 1900s, defending the integrity of our Bible. It was being attacked in those early years of the 20th century. He said that a man that had a profound effect on him when he was a student was a famous scientist at Princeton University named Joseph Henry, and he happened to be his student helper. Joseph Henry was one of the first men that actually did experiments with electricity. And he said, as a young student, they would be in the lab helping this man, this great scientist, with his experiments, and they would be about to try some new experiment with electricity. And nobody's ever done what they're about to do before, and they knew this. Everybody was cognizant that they're making history as they're doing these things. And they said that before they would actually begin, Joseph Henry, this noted scientist, would raise up his hands and he would call on the students, "Let's worship God in this moment." And if they asked why, he would say, "God is here, and we're about to ask him a question." The point I want to make this morning is that we cannot, as God's church, get so comfortable with how things are that we rock along week after week, Sunday after Sunday, month after month, and not even notice that God is with us or not. So three things that I want to leave you with this morning. God's presence is what makes a church so unique. Russ Blowers was a preacher in a church in Indianapolis. He also happened to be a member of the Rotary Club there. And each week at this Rotary Club, they would have a member of the club stand up and introduce himself and give a brief statement about his job. And when it came time for Russ to do this, Russ being a minister, this is what he said. "I am with a global enterprise. We have branches in every country in the world. We have our representatives in nearly every parliament and boardroom on earth. We are into motivation and behavior alteration. We run hospitals, TV stations, crisis pregnancy centers, universities, publishing houses, nursing homes, and radio. We care for our clients from birth to death. We are into life insurance and fire insurance. We perform spiritual heart transplants. Our original organizer owns all the real estate on Earth, plus an assortment of galaxies and constellations. He knows everything and is everywhere. Our product is free for the asking because there is not enough money to buy it. Our CEO was born in a hick town, worked as a carpenter, didn't own a home. He was misunderstood by his family, hated by his enemies, walked on water, was condemned to death without a trial, and rose from the dead. And I talk about him every chance I get." What makes the church different from any other organization in the world is this: our founder is alive. We talk to him. We meet with him. We hear from him. He moves in our midst. That's what separates us from any other charity or compassion-based organization on earth. Look what Moses said in Exodus 33, verses 15 and 16. "Then Moses said to him, 'If your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth?'" What makes you and me unique is not that we have nice habits or a special vocabulary. What makes us unique is that when an unbeliever comes in here, they quickly begin to realize there's something different in this place. There's a presence in that place. And if God is not in this place, there is nothing particularly special about what we do. God's presence is what makes sin so ugly. And we'll talk more about this next week, about how mad Moses got. But I'll tell you, he never understood the darkness of idolatry because he spent so much time in the light. It's amazing that when you read through God's word, that whenever someone comes into the presence of God, the very first thing that they become aware of is the awfulness of sin. Remember how Isaiah responded in God's presence? I'm a man who lives among an unclean people, and I have unclean lips. What did Peter do? Jesus is on the shore, and he urges them to lower their nets to catch some fish on the shore when they've been fishing all night to no avail, and then their nets just cannot hold the amount of fish that come into them. And it says, when Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." One reason you treat sin so trivially, one reason you are so flippant about that which should disgust you, is that you do not spend enough time in the presence of God. What happened to Moses after he had tasted of the glory of God being in his presence on that mountain? He just could not be satisfied with any more of the glory of this world. God's presence makes sin look so ugly. One more thing. God's presence is what makes intercession so urgent. Who's going to be responsible for Israel when Israel is irresponsible? Here is basically Moses' choice. God's going to destroy them. So does Moses choose judgment or revival? Moses chose revival, and he went to battle for Israel on his knees. And I want you to see what God said to Moses. Look at verse 17 of Exodus 33. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'I will do the very thing you have asked, because I'm pleased with you, and I know you by name.' Moses shaped the future for a nation that didn't have a future unless he interceded for them. I believe this. If you have spent time in the presence of God, you start to pray with passion for people who haven't been in God's presence. Let me ask you a question. Do you pray for your church? Do you pray for me, your pastor? You need to pray for the leaders of our church, our elders. You need to ask God to give us the special manifestation of his presence in our midst. Otherwise, we have a tendency to drift into idleness. Stand up. I want to pray over you. Father God, we need you to clean house for us. We are so easily lulled into an infatuation with idols because we simply want to do what we want to do. And we just don't want to do what you want us to do. Forgive us. In this moment, right now, we repent. Take away our idols. Just give us Jesus. We need Jesus. It's in his name we pray.